Welcome to Unique Connections at the Table. I'm Dr. Beverly Samways, and each episode we invite you to join the conversation and discover new ways of seeing the world, particularly in relation to those with learning disabilities. So pull up a chair, the table's set, and we're so glad you're here. Hey, Jen.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Yeah, it's a sunny. The sun's coming. I don't think it's sunny yet, but the sun is on its way. The weather's better generally.
Hooray! That is brilliant. Something that makes a difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it really matters to me at the moment because I sold my car, so I'm walking and cycling everywhere. So wow. I'm constantly on the weather report.
How's that going?
It's fine. It's just temporary until I find the right car, but I've done it before in the spring and just had a few weeks where I didn't have a car, and it works okay for a time and then it becomes a nightmare.
Sure. So we need it to be quite dry at least as much as possible for you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm literally like checking, oh, it's raining. That'll be an Uber because I do not cycle in the rain. That's my fair weather cyclist. Yeah, that's a boundary. Yeah. So what about you? What's going on in your life?
Things are good. Exciting news is some of our really good friends have bought the house next door to us.
That's the dream, isn't it?
It's so nice. So the people that lived there before, they were really lovely neighbours, but they worked abroad. So they'd spend months and months with the house being empty. And that obviously meant we could be as noisy as we wanted to. But it was just very hard to build that kind of relationship other than just that we take each other's parcels in occasionally.
Well, I often post your stuff to them, so that's awkward, isn't it? Because then they're away for months.
Absolutely, absolutely. Whereas now I'll be like, it's fine, I can just text next door. And it's great because my husband grew up with really good friends living next door. They had a gate through between the gardens, so the pigs would just pop in and out all the time. It was absolutely it was all open. Anybody could pop in and join the other family for tea and this kind of thing.
I had that. My best friend lived two doors down and we had a big space where we could play. So she was like, we would go around all the... Yeah, you didn't plan it. It would just be a knock on the door. Is Bev's playing out?
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, it was very nice.
Yeah, we were playing the ball in the garden and I threw the ball too hard and it went next door and I was like, it's fine.
Yeah.
The interesting dynamic we've got, though, is my husband and I are both quite extroverted. Like, we love being around. We really get energy from people. And our son is much quieter. He's generally the, I'm going to wait for all the big busyness to go, and then and then I'll do something, and then I'll come forward. And it's hard at this age to know whether that's just his age, whether that's he hasn't yet trusted the other people there, it all feels too new, all of those sorts of things. So we've got this interesting dynamic of going... For the four of us adults, it's great they're moving in. We've got all these plans, but actually we don't know whether this is going to be right for the children because we can kind of get a bit of like, this is my house and this is how I want to do things. But suddenly you have then, oh, actually it's his house as well. And is it right for him that they have a key and just pop in all the time? Is it right for him that we have this like open garden effect and this sort of thing? And it's so interesting, isn't it, when we think about it as being not just our house, but also our children's home as well. And that dynamic of, just because this feels right for me as an adult, who's holding the power, as we talked about before, is this also right for the young person who has a less say in their space, has less say and less agency in it. So it's also quite an interesting vessel that we're having at the moment.
That's nice. And the thing is, you won't know, will you? It's just a case, it's going to take some time. He's going to have probably some ups and downs in working out how he feels about that. And he'll have to work out what is safe for him, what feels comfortable to him.
The safety and trust is so important, isn't it? But I think when we're adults, we can have a feeling of, I can gauge from this where I feel okay and that I can move away.
Yeah.
We can kind of go, actually, do I feel safe with this person? And we can put it into a language. Do I trust them to give me a lift home? Are they a good driver? This kind of thing. Do I trust them to cook a meal that I'm going to enjoy? do I trust them to listen when I need it to? And we can weigh that up for ourselves. But I think for young people, they're still in a different kind of phase of brain development, and a different phase of working out what that's like. It may just be a feeling that there isn't the language for, in the same way that you and I might have.
That's really interesting, because trust is such a, it's one of those things, it's a feeling thing, isn't it? And we do it instinctively a lot of the time. We work out how, even you say like this, there's friends that I trust deeply with my heart and my personal life, but I won't get in their car. They're just terrible drivers. They don't know that. I just always say, no, I'll get myself there. So it works on all these different levels, and we just work it out, don't we, between us. Quietly, it's not, because we can make those choices.
And that's a great thing, is that you're like, I can get myself there.
Exactly.
But when some of the young people that we've worked with, some of the young people that we know, so much reliance is on somebody else doing things for them.
Yeah.
Even if they're saying, actually, I don't want this, I don't want that person.
Yeah.
Put down to, oh, that's their behaviour. Oh, that's a problem.
Yeah.
Oh, they're just being like this because of they are. Rather than recognising, they're trusting themselves, trusting what it is that they need.
Yeah, that's really good. Mm-hmm. So that's because we're thinking about trustworthiness and transparency today. And if we start from that space with the young people, particularly young people with severe learning disabilities, those with no spoken communication, they are expected, aren't they, to trust a whole range of people at speed. It's hard to imagine needing support with, some of the young people I've worked with historically, they needed help with everything. Some of them were in wheelchairs, but also needed help with eating their dinner and personal care. And even like, if you're in a wheelchair and it's not electric, you don't even get to choose which room to be in. Somebody just brings you into a room and puts you there. And you're right, the expectation is that they trust people to do that, even strangers sometimes to do that, if there's like an emergency staffing situation. And if they resist a person because they don't trust them, it's called a challenging behaviour. That's a really difficult space to be, isn't it?
Because we don't expect people around us to trust somebody immediately.
No. No,
but
we don't.
This interesting dynamic happens where we go, okay, well, of course, young person, because you live in this home, because this is the school, because these are the needs you have, of course you must trust somebody straight away.
Mm.
I don't feel like that's what people are designed for.
No, it isn't. I've been, as we were just talking about before, that I've been working on a book of three stories of young people that I've worked with in a research capacity. And one of the stories, so it's not her real name, but it's Cassie's story. And there's a part of that that's like really resonating as we're talking about this. So it's a situation where I'd been swimming with her, but she was with her support worker, who was a male staff member who she knew reasonably well, but she probably was closer to me. But because of my position and my role that I was there, it wasn't me that went to the changing rooms with her, it was her male support worker. And she was like 14, 15 at the time. So she ends up, I don't know, I wasn't in there, but she ends up 14, 15 year old being supported into her swimming costume by a male staff member who she thinks is fine, but she doesn't have a strong relationship with. And just how hard that was, and that's the expectation. She just goes along with that. And actually, one of the things that stood out to me is that just like broke my heart, is when she came, she had a swimming costume with a racer back, which I guess for a guy is difficult to negotiate with, like it's not an easy setup. And when she came out to the pool, she had it on back to front. I just felt for her, because like, I'm sure she knew it was on back to front, but couldn't tell him. He didn't know. He probably thought, what on earth is this contraption? How is he supposed to know how to put a female swimming costume on? And so she came to the door, I remember, and I saw her, and I said to her supporter, like, take her back in, like, don't she shouldn't come out here. I said, that's on back to front. And he said, no, it isn't. And I said, it is. Take it back in and turn it round. But that experience, like, is such a, it was just compromised her dignity. But
one of the things interesting happened there for you as well, because he didn't trust you.
No.
To know what kind of swimming costume, how it fits and how it looks.
No. No, absolutely. And then this thing happens after the, so we get in the pool, I'm in the pool with her, we have this really interesting session, and then she gets out, and then on the way, as we're leaving the pool and walking to the house, she takes this guy's top and she tries to take it off him. She literally tries to undress him. And I remember thinking at the time, because I was being slightly dense and slow, like, what is she doing? Like, what on earth does she think she's doing? And he was saying, you know, he was really, to be fair to him, he was super gentle and super compassionate about it. He was just really patient. He didn't say very much, and he just sort of, you know, tried. But I remember thinking, wow, this is such a loss of dignity for him. He's here with me. I don't know him very well. And suddenly I'm seeing, you know, I could see his chest. I could see, because she's trying to pull his top off. And I remember feeling for him. And then there was this moment when I said to Cassie, it's not kind to force someone to take their clothes off. And as even as I said it, I realised this has happened to you. Mm. Like, not necessarily with this guy. I'm not saying that he had necessarily done that. He was a kind person, but she would have certainly had experiences in her past where she was not ready to get changed, but that was the routine, that was the schedule, and that there was some kind of, you know, I could feel that she was not, but it was being treated as like a challenging behavior moment. But I realized that what was happening to her was she was saying, I am sick of people, and I'm sick of people dressing me with my clothes back to front. I'm sick of this. I'm sick of having to trust people to do something a certain way, and it's not. And I felt like she was just showing me, like, this is what it's like. This is what it's like for me to need this amount of support. Yeah, it was really, yeah, it was like a, it felt like a big moment for me. But it's hard, isn't it? Because, you know, we've got retention and recruitment crisis, and that does mean that we sometimes have staff that don't know the young people or the adults, and that come in, and their job is to support them with really, really difficult and personal things. And we're asking a young person to trust them deeply in those moments.
But we know that, and yet we're not doing anything to change our practice.
Yeah.
So if on a one-off, somebody was going to come in who the young person hadn't met, then it's fair for it to say, actually, on this one-off, we weren't able to talk to them about the fact that it was somebody different, explain, try and move things around to make it somebody familiar. But we know we have a recruitment or a retention crisis.
Yeah.
And so we need to be coming from that place first and recognising, on a regular basis, it will not be familiar stuff to young people. And on a regular basis, it will not be staff doing things in the way the young person wants to.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, the staff aren't able to trust that they are supported, that they're having all the information that they need as well.
And I think that's when it starts layering up, doesn't it? And I was talking briefly to you about probably one of my first experiences of caring for a young person with severe learning disabilities. It was definitely my first shift in this particular setting. And it was a young lady in a wheelchair. She had sensory loss, physical disabilities, learning disabilities, autism. She had no spoken communication. And I could see, I didn't go anywhere near her all evening because I could see she was furiously angry, just pouring off her. And then it got to the evening, and they did it, like, bear in mind, I don't even know the staff that was there. I didn't know anybody, and I certainly didn't know this young lady. And somebody let's call her Jessica, this girl. So somebody just says to me, do you want to take Jessica for a bath? Like that. I don't know anything about her. I haven't read her care plan. We haven't even interacted. And I was like, okay. I was like probably 22 at the time. Just want to do a good job. Don't know any different. And then as I take this Jessica's wheelchair and I begin to take her down the corridor. And as I'm going down, one of the staff members said, just make sure you take her arm splints off last. And she had these arm splints on, keeping her arms straight. So I had to hoist her into the bath. So I hoisted her over the bath and then at the last minute took these arm splints off. And she was a chronic self-injurer. No one had told me. No one had mentioned it. And as soon as these arm splints are off, she began to hit and punch herself in the head over and over and over and over again. And I think of that, you know, I'll never forget that event. Actually, I'm still in touch with that young lady. We actually ended up working together for years. We're still friends. But I remember that because there was a clear intention. Like there was no transparency from the staff towards me, and there was they deliberately broke trust. So they set me up to go and support a young lady that they knew it was going to be a terrible experience, and they sent me into it. Mm-hmm. And that level of unkindness towards like the. You know, the, like the novice who's just walked in the door. Like, I need to knock me down a peg or two. But then also the level of lost trust for Jessica, who has this strange stranger with her in a cold bathroom. Yeah, I remember it. Just such a powerful experience. Terrible experience. But it sort of set, in the end, it set inside me a determination, firstly, to continue to work with this young lady and see if we could make some progress, but secondarily to think about like what are we building here, what are we doing, and how can these places be safe when there's no transparency, there's no honesty, there's no clear, you know, nobody wants to tell you the bad stuff. No one wants to tell you that something's going to be really difficult.
But yeah, and that was like, isn't there, where people also want to say all the bad stuff that's like the moany stuff.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it's so terrible that we've got to do these really long days. Oh, yes. It's so terrible that the pay's like this. This kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's really interesting that there's like this openness to share the bad that everybody knows. You know what I mean? Everybody knows how long the shift is. We're all going to start talking about it.
Yeah.
Everybody knows what the pay is, yet we're all going to talk about it.
Yeah.
The things that actually could make a difference and make it all a bit easier is this real protection of like, I'm not going to be transparent about this in case that changes it. But then it sets up this culture of not being able to trust anybody.
And I think, you know, when I look back at, you know, often we say this a lot, don't we? These things run through the culture. So the team were not transparent with me and put me in a place of broken trust. I then play that out with Jessica. But above that, it was the same, you know, from the management, from the whole organisation, there was really no one talking about the fact that this young lady was self-injuring in such a terrible way. There wasn't a strategy, there wasn't a plan, nobody was seeking any help about it. So that, it comes from the top, doesn't it? And it feeds all the way down into these moments between like me and Jessica where it's gone so horrifically wrong. Mm. And so how do we build transparency and trustworthiness like into the culture from the top down, which, because that's what it would take, wouldn't it, to change those kinds of moments?
I think we have to begin by getting curious about why it's not there. What do we imagine to happen if we are transparent? So those staff, what I wonder what they imagined was going to happen if they said to you, this is what's happening with Jessica at the moment.
Yeah, I think they probably thought I wouldn't do it. And that, Jen, is really interesting because I think that's why transparency often gets lost all the way through organisations. So we've seen, haven't we, recently, in sort of different spaces and different organisations, that there's a reluctance to tell the real story of the work that's done from the organisation because of the fear that funding will be lost opportunities will be lost, that no one will trust the organisation if they're candid about the fact that they are caring not for happy, grateful children, but for children who have long trauma histories, who have experiences of bereavement and loss in their past, and that the work is difficult. And sometimes there's whole days where a child is very distressed, and that is them, that is the organisation's work, that's what they do. And that level of transparency, I think organisations across the board are struggling with that right now, because they know there's a squeeze on finance, and so they tell all the good stories, and they're really struggling to say, actually, we need to acknowledge that the work we do is super hard, and we don't, it's not one delightful story to the next.
But this feels endemic over us as society, that we really struggle to share that things aren't always happy, perfect, beautiful, shiny all the time.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, the sort of highlight reel culture.
Definitely. And then that plays out in all kinds of places. Because for somebody to acknowledge, actually, there are times at work where this young person is sad because really difficult things have happened to them, and they are sad in response to that. Of course they're sad. It also opens up, and there are times that I am sad. And if I think about my own personality, and I think about the fact that this, I am not happy all the time, then what then? There's this huge fear of sadness and anger, that if we do trust people that those things are happening for us, it's going to happen forever. Or that person's not going to want to be around, all of those kind of things. And that plays out in these homes, these schools, these workplaces, plays out amongst the staff, and it plays out amongst the young people. And it's almost like we hide away these emotions that we all have.
Yeah. But it does erode trust, doesn't it? The lack of transparency. Because if the story, I was talking about this at a conference a couple of weeks ago, and I was really interested at how it landed. Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking about grief and bereavement and learning disabilities. And I was saying, like, what's the meta-narrative of your organisation? Because if your meta-narrative, not necessarily what you say on your website, but what you say when someone new walks in the door, if what you say is, we're a happy school with happy staff and happy children, this is a happy place, like, what happens to the child who's grieving the loss of a parent or a grandparent? Where do they go with their emotion? And how could a staff member sit with them and let them grieve without feeling like they're doing something subversive? Because this is a happy place. So what do we do with loss and grief and bereavement? And that was really interesting, because I had some like interesting conversations afterwards. For some of the organisations that we trust and we know they do good work, but they were saying, this is like, we do this, like, we know we need to make a space for grief. We've been doing grief work, we've been doing bereavement work, but we definitely say this is our meta narrative: happy, happy, happy. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult, isn't it? Because we're not saying, like, go the other way. You know, don't, when somebody walks in the school, you say, like, oh, this is a place where everybody's grieving. Like, that's not the goal. But what about saying this is a place where we're working on resilience and we're working on emotional literacy and emotional honesty? And we know that it's okay to be sad, and because it's recoverable. And so, you know, we're a place that's big enough to hold all of that. And I think that's also where some organisations are struggling. Like, they're not sure that they're big enough, like, internally, to emotionally hold and contain the difficulty of the work that they're doing. So they're defaulting to these, easier narratives.
Or it becomes the job of one person to hold all of that.
Yes.
And they then become like the vacuum for all of the different. Actually, if I'm having a bad day, then I go and see Sarah because she'll listen to me, that kind of thing. We might end up trusting one person, though, what one person holds it for the whole organisation. It becomes so tricky then, because it becomes that person's job.
Yeah.
And somebody else then can't be like, actually, let's change this as a whole culture. Let's try and do something that is much bigger than just, oh, it's okay if you're having a bad day because you can go and talk to Sarah. Rather than actually change everything about this, because we want to make this different for our young people. We want to make this a safer and a more trustworthy space for everybody.
Yeah, and I think when you've got one person or one department holding the difficulty, that's often where you start to see, you know, people burn out, isn't it, if they're being asked to hold that. But also sometimes you'll see small pockets of the organisation that starts to fail because the burden of carrying the difficulty of the work has overwhelmed them. Yeah. So, and I guess, like, so there's a really difficult job around transparency, isn't it? Like actually saying the work that we actually do. And then, but I think the flip side is, like, with the transparency, we make ourselves more trustworthy, don't we? Because we are, people can trust, they recognise the narrative that we're telling and it connects with the work that they actually know and believe. They know they're doing that job. I was saying at the conference, like, we were talking about the, you know, the, I was like, your staff are doing this anyway, but do you acknowledge it? Like, they are supporting pupils who are grieving and who have experienced loss. Mm-hmm. You've been doing it for years, but do you ever mention it? Do you ever mm-hmm. talk about it? If you don't, then the team, your staff are having to do it subversively. They're having to do it in a way that isn't transparent, and it's very hard to sustain it.
Would you say this have done well in any of the projects that you were visiting in America?
I think one of the projects I went to in New York State, I met with the CEO and she was able to talk in very candid terms about the levels of trauma in their young people. And I did see that going all the way through the system. So then I met with those that were running children's homes, and the level of sort of candidacy about the experiences of the young people they were supporting and what that was costing them as an organisation and the staff team was probably more open and more frank than they didn't want to tell me. We're doing amazing things, everything's brilliant. You know, they were saying, we'll tell you some of the stories of the young people that we've worked with and how difficult that is. Yeah, the toll that that takes on our teams and how we're, like, bolstering them and making sure that that work can be done and it can be done well. Yeah, and I think that immediately, like, I felt like I trusted them. Do you know what I mean? You're like, oh, you're really clear what you're up to. And there was one of the things I noticed through the system was there was a sense of security. Mm-hmm. So the staff were secure in the jobs they did. They were confident mm-hmm. because they knew what they were doing. They knew that the all the way up to the top were confident in what they were doing. So there was a sense of trust running through the system mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. there was transparency. And then they were well boundaried as well, which is another real key aspect of
trustworthiness. And even that conversation they had with you was boundaried, because they weren't saying, here are all the problems, we're desperate, help, you know, all that sort of, we're giving you all of these problems. Yeah. Anything like this, was there? There was an acknowledgement of, we know this.
Yeah.
And this is where we were.
Yeah, and they were clear about, like, the information that they would or wouldn't give me and the places that they would take me. And I always think that's a good sign, you know, when someone wants to, like, throw open the doors and, like, introducing you to people that, you know, some organisations, they'll want to introduce you to every child that you walk past. And it just feels like, this is not very well boundaried. Like, I don't need to meet everybody. But they were, they were boundaried with me as well. And I always think that's it's a good sign, recognises it's respectful, isn't it, of the young people that we're living and learning there. Yeah, so yeah, I probably did see some good examples of that. Yeah.
And that's so important, isn't it, to be able to hold on to, because otherwise we do otherwise end up focusing on all the parts that we see that aren't working.
Yeah.
But it does give hope to see when things are going well, see what it is that's holding on.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like, we all want to be trustworthy, don't we? And I think most of us are wired to be like, I do want to be transparent. I guess in these spaces, it just takes some courage. It is actually quite a courageous thing to be frank and candid about the work that we're doing, because we've had decades of, you know, of narrative that says, you know, that particularly young people with severe learning disabilities that have really high support needs, that, you know, trauma is not a part of their life, that they're innocent, that they're oblivious, they're not affected by, you know, they we're trying to counteract decades of narrative that has completely wiped this story out from these kids' lives. And so to bring in a new narrative that says, we understand that the work we're doing is, you know, it is in part helping our young people to recover from their difficult experiences and their overwhelming emotions. It's like a, it goes against the flow and it takes some courage. Yeah.
Maybe we'll spend some more time thinking about boundaries another week.
Yeah.
A little bit on that, haven't we? But just sort of some of the things we've said have made me think, actually, spending some time really thinking about what boundaries looks like. These kind of things are also going to be helpful.
Yeah, that would be useful, because I do think it's, yeah, and again, from top to bottom, how do we help the young people have boundaries? Yeah, that might link in nicely into when we think about, like, empowerment, voice and choice as well, like thinking about empowering young people to establish boundaries, and then how we boundary the organisation in a way that's safe and secure.
We'll come back in for another week when we'll be thinking
about Yeah. Thanks, Jen. See you next time. Thanks so much for listening today. Before you go, can you help us with something? We want to make sure these conversations reach the people who need to hear them. So if there's someone you think would benefit from listening to this, we would just love it if you shared it. See you next time.